There's a wonderful metaphor that one of these radical libertarians used, which is that, you know, to think that democracies can self-bind is like having a chastity belt on with a key within reach. And in its extreme version, it does take that step that most neoliberals don't take, which is to say, what if instead of just refashioning the state, we just do away with the state altogether and replace all of the functions of the state with private service providers? You know, it's often treated as like a completely absurd proposition. But in fact, it's the direction in which much of capitalism has been moving for some time now. It's helpful, I think, to reconceive of the challenge of European near future right now is one between kind of, is democratic sovereignty something that can be exerted, or will it be eroded through these small acts of kind of effective secession?
Guys, hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Dissents Podcast. I'm your host, Lucas Ondrejka. We have another one in English this time. On the program this week, Quinn Slobodian. He's a professor of the history of ideas, and we want to talk about his latest book, Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. Quinn, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, Quinn, in Crack Up Capitalism, you show how radical free marketeers try to break up or crack up the landscape of nation states in order to find the perfect space for radical capitalism. Mm-hmm. One could describe them as anarcho-capitalists who work towards a world of micronations, private cities, and tax havens. For German listeners, Quinn's book just launched in Germany, the title Kapitalismus ohne Demokratie. For starters, Quinn, capitalism and democracy, these are oftentimes conceived as the very same, actually. Mm-hmm. But you describe how market radicals try to undermine democracy by establishing islands of radical capitalism. Who do we have to picture when we talk about the threat of capitalism without democracy?
Well, I think the story that I tell in the book is kind of needs to be placed in a particular moment or a particular time. And that's the kind of era after the Cold War, when a lot of people would think that capitalism and democracy had sort of found their way to each other in a kind of harmony, right? This was the sort of end of history idea, is that capitalist democracy was the only model left. So one of the first surprises of my book is that it's precisely at that time that some more radical libertarians start to flirt with the idea of non-democratic capitalism and start to feel all the more suspicious and concerned, actually, about the direction that democracy is going. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that they think that the kind of supranational institutions that were built after the Cold War, so the European Union, the World Trade Organization, the NAFTA Treaty in the US, Canada and Mexico, there was a feeling that democracy was kind of going wrong because it was being taken over by new forms of leftism. So communism was dead, but now you had environmentalism, feminism, activism around racial minorities, civil rights sort of getting put into overdrive in their mind. In other words, wokeism had sort of taken over supranational institutions in the minds of many libertarians. So they started getting worried that capitalism, rather than being kind of given a perfect home in the 1990s, needed to be created afresh and anew. And they started looking around the world for places where they thought capitalism was in better health and where it was sort of thriving in ways unencumbered by trade unionism, multi-party politics, the blockades of everyday government. The places that they got excited about were places like Dubai, places like Singapore, places like Hong Kong, actually. Mm. So the storyline of the book is a little bit less that some libertarians sit down and concoct things in their head, and more that they kind of scan the global landscape and find places that look like they were working better than the Western version of capitalism in their mind.
Yeah, Dubai, Singapore, Hong Kong, these are all special economic zones, and they are situated like most of the zones in authoritarian countries. But I think it's important to recognize also that this zoning off also happens within Western liberal democracies, for example, in the European Union. It's also that here market radicals and right-wing governments work hand in hand to establish zones with privileges for global capital. So talk a bit, Quinn, about the category of the zones. Which comes in many shapes and why it's so central when we think about the threat of capitalism without democracy.
Sure. Well, this is also kind of one of the proposals of the book is that we need to kind of understand right-wing politics differently than we have so far. So I think that the natural framing of the last few years has been that you kind of had two settings for the world economy. Either we were on globalization, like the 90s and early 2000s, or since 2016, we've had a kind of a click back to nationalism and a kind of a withdrawal of, countries back behind their borders, back behind drawbridges, and so on. The story of the book is really about a third category that I think represents best this idea of capitalism without democracy. And that is the category of the zone. So what the book really, recounts is the story of the last 40 years or so as one of nations continuing to be intact, but being punctured and perforated and having little holes punched in them to create special legal spaces that have less taxes, less laws, less regulations, less oversight by democratic governments. And that this is sort of the way that capitalism has operated in the last 40 years. You can think here of export processing zones in poorer countries in the global south. You can think of the way that China opened up and reformed, not all at once, but through these small spaces along the coast. You can think of the popularity of things like free ports and enterprise zones in places like Britain. So the story is not so much one that they envision of a kind of a transformation of a world from nations immediately into one where we have broken up all existing nation states into competing small micro entities. Rather, it's about existing nations being sort of undermined from inside by the creation of new kind of legal entities. And that's something that is already happening. So it's not like you need to sort of look into the deep future. The popularity of the special economic zone, especially for right-wing governments, is pretty widespread. Italy, under the Lega and now under Meloni's government, has introduced special economic zones throughout the Italian south. Poland turned its entire country into a special economic zone in 2020, under the PIS, ethno-nationalist chauvinist government. Orbán's Hungary, usually held up as an example of the ultimate kind of nationalist politics, has also introduced special economic zones. So the vision that we see here is one of this sort of termite-like eating away at existing nation states into smaller spaces, with the idea that eventually those areas will suck in investment and suck in the mobile money and sort of starve the rest of the nations of their resources.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, in your book, I learned that nowadays we have like over 5,000 of those special economic zones. And of course, they come in many different facets. And a lot of them are situated like in these kind of what Branko Milanovic is calling political capitalism, like in these authoritarian countries like Dubai, for example, or China. But you already mentioned that, of course, also in Western liberal democracies, we have this tendency towards undermining democracy and democratic rights of citizens or of workers by having these extra legal islands of capitalism, these zones. I kind of feel sometimes when we look at these anarcho-capitalist visions that people mistake it for only kind of some private cities, like the most extreme cases in Honduras, for example, the Zetes. But it starts way earlier, and private cities there were capitalists can write their own laws, have their own police and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They're kind of only the most extreme case.
Right.
So maybe elaborate a bit more on how this also affects like Western liberal democracies.
Sure.
And how we have to think about this continuum of zones where, of course, we have an extreme end.
Sure. Right. I completely agree with you that there's a tendency to have this discussion almost in terms of speculative science fiction type futures, a la Neal Stephenson or something. There will no longer be legacy nation states, and all there will be is like the world broken up into these tiny competing privately owned spaces. And it's true that at the far end of imagination, that is what some of the people in my book are sort of hoping for. But I think that if the book was just about that small handful of radical libertarians, it wouldn't maybe be that important or that worthwhile as a story to tell. Mm. I think that the deeper story that the book is trying to get to, it's about modernity in the 20th century in particular. And what I mean by that is that the stories that I tell in my classroom, for example, as a historian and a history professor of global history, is there are a couple of big stories we talk about. We talk about the rise of popular sovereignty as a kind of way of organizing humanity. So the nation and national self-determination becomes the kind of expression of the dreams and wishes of the people who live inside of a particular territory. Since the French Revolution or the American Revolution, you know, slowly we have the rise of the sort of nation-state principle as the way that the world is organized. That reaches its kind of high point, you could say, in the 1960s and 70s with the end of overseas European empires. And at that moment where places like Tanzania and Kenya and Mozambique became independent, there was an idea that was quite widespread of so-called modernization theory. So the assumption was all these small little units would eventually converge along a timeline and join a place like the United States. And you would have like miniature welfare states across the world, and everyone would move towards industrial forms of capitalism over time. If you read the work of social scientists in the 1960s, their concern was not that everyone wouldn't be able to develop. The assumption was everyone would develop towards industrialism. The problem was, what would America do once it had gone past industrial development? Would they need new frontiers? Would we need to come up with new projects, you know, exploring the moon, exploring our interiority? These are literally the kind of like mid-century problems. Mm. So if the 20th century was dominated by this idea of nations as the kind of actors of history, all marching along a timeline towards an industrial moment of convergence, what the zone does, it sort of shows how already at that time in the 1970s, that idea was being kind of undermined by individual actors, but also just by the dynamics of global capitalist competition. So my book very intentionally begins with Milton Friedman standing in Hong Kong in 1978 and getting very excited about what Hong Kong was like and the way it operated. He was excited because it worked against those very trends of modernization. He was excited because Hong Kong was not a nation. It was not a place that was working towards a welfare state. It was not a place that had accepted the idea of one person, one vote democracy. It was a kind of anachronism. It was like this leftover of an earlier era. But because it was a leftover in earlier era, it was competing very successfully economically. So they could govern the colony like a corporation. Insofar as there was collective decision making, it was by the heads of companies alongside appointed officials. So this sort of, I think, introduced a kind of a new way to get around the otherwise inevitable march of the principle of national self-determination, democracy, and expectations of industrial modernity. Mm-hmm. Now you could say, no, you can actually create these tiny little places that are free of democratic oversight, free of expectations of social state and redistribution, and maybe make those like the cockpit and the kind of operating space for this more efficient form of capitalist organization. So what the book then shows is how little Hong Kongs become a very popular and enduring idea. You first want to create little Hong Kongs in Thatcher's Britain, in Reagan's America. Deng Xiaoping in China is also creating little Hong Kongs on the coast. Up into the 2000s, you know, why do we have that zone in Honduras you referenced? Because Paul Romer stood on stage in 2009 and said, what we need to do is create small Hong Kongs around the world. And to do that, we need to forget about the idea of national sovereignty, forget about the idea of democracy, and just concentrate on creating efficient small territories that can respond to global demand for services, for manufacturing, and so on. So that's the, for me, the kind of the meta story or narrative I'm telling in the book is about the kind of the end of the dream of modernization, the end of the inevitability of democracy as a organizing principle, and the way that the multiplication of those many zones and the success that they've had in a place like China, as you said, has over half of the world's special economic zones. They've been very popular in India under BJP government, which has also successfully combined sort of authoritarian social values with the principle of economic competition and openness to foreign investment. So it's a way to, I think, give us a new story about global history, really, which is that we are not just on a march towards the nation. And when something bad happens, we assume it's just nationalism and the 1930s all over again. Actually, many of the problems we have with democracy or the and the specific quality of nationalism is a version of nationalism that's in a hybrid relationship with this new outwardly focused piece of politics called zones. And I think that, you know, when you start seeing through the zone lens, you start seeing things that you wouldn't see otherwise. So another example is the world of logistics and infrastructure. So the way that Britain, for example, you know, controlled its empire was often not through controlling every patch of the empire, but having these sort of strong points, naval bases on the coast that would also be trading posts or free ports all around the edge of India into Southeast Asia, coast of Africa. And one of the interesting things about looking at things through the zone is you see how those places where the British Empire used to have been, was previously, are now often owned and operated by former British colonies. So the Dubai-owned logistics company DP World owns and operates a network of ports from Vancouver all the way to Indonesia, and owns and operates, for example, the main container port going into London, the Thames Gateway port. Singapore, similarly, former British colony, owns and operates many of these ports globally. India now is getting into the business. Adani Ports and Special Economic Zones operates and owns the port in Haifa in Israel. So they can become important geopolitically too. And it, these are places that are, you know, sort of extensions of corporate governance and corporate rule. And I think that if we start to see all of those holes in the map of the world of nation states, then we start to understand the precarity and kind of uncertainty a bit more clearly.
Yeah. This is, of course, not a spontaneous process, but it's driven by like political capitalist elites, like the former communist government in China, for example. But also, you mentioned Milton Friedman by neoliberal economists and activists from Western nations. When we look at them, maybe you can explain a bit their underlying ideology behind this idea of capitalism without democracy, of fragmenting democratic oversight, and also the idea of privatizing the state or statelessness, because this kind of seems to me like a radicalization sort of. So whereas in mainstream neoliberalism, they want to win over the states as they did in the 70s and onwards, right? Thatcher, Reagan, and then in Germany, Schröder. But this version of neoliberalism kind of wants to dismantle, or in the most extreme case, privatize government. Mm-hmm. And sure, there's contradictions, all sorts of, because they love like the authoritarian governments. So in a sense, the term anarcho-capitalism or libertarianism is kind of an oxymoron, kind of. Because they depend so much on authoritarian rule. But yeah, explain a bit when it comes to this radicalization of neoliberalism, what's their underlying ideology?
Sure. I think it's helpful to go back to one of your first questions, which is to just ask about the relationship between capitalism and democracy. So the kind of standing assumption or standard assumption nowadays, I think, would be that the two are somehow complementary or mutually supporting each other. But historically, people have not necessarily seen it that way, right? I mean, the left has often assumed that the progression of capitalism would lead to concentrations of power that would lead to monopoly, which would then actually quite naturally often lead to state-owned monopoly and create a kind of a passageway to a more socialistic model that would actually extinguish democracy. So this is something that even Schumpeter thought, for example. He thought that democracy and capitalism did not work well together because capitalism led to monopoly, which would eventually extinguish capitalism. Other people would have argued that true democracy could not coexist with capitalism because to actually have a kind of popular collective control over the means of production would be inconsistent with capitalism. So this idea of the two things having a happy coexistence is actually quite recent. And it's for the most part not a position that's shared by the leading neoliberal intellectuals. So the core idea of ordoliberalism in Germany, or the idea of Friedrich Hayek or Ludwig von Mises, would be that democracy actually constitutes an ongoing threat to the stability of capitalism for very good reasons, which is that if you give everyone a vote, and you say you can use this vote to sort of ask for something from your government, then they assume that people will use that vote to say, well, we want material goods, we want redistribution, we want a bit of the profits, and that that would eventually, you know, stop the machinery of profit creation because the state would become a boita, is the word that's always used, the prey of the voters. So you needed actually a set of institutions to prevent the people from just exploiting the state through democracy and thus destroying capitalism. The way that you do that is often through legal institutions and mechanisms that prevent, let's say, the nationalization of core industries. So you might say there's a limit to what people can ask for. You can't say that private property can be infringed on or taken into public ownership. They might do things like what's precisely what's happening in Germany right now with the debt break. This is a perfect example of a neoliberal instrument, which says it doesn't matter if democracy wants something because we have decided in advance that democracy is not allowed to enter this territory, which is sacred for protecting the economy and protecting capitalism by extension. The way that that is often described is these are called Ulysses Pacts or Ulysses Agreements. The same way that when Ulysses passed the sirens, he needed to have himself tied to the mast to prevent himself from smashing into the rocks. This idea of pre-commitment is often assumed to be necessary by neoliberals. These so-called counter-majoritarian institutions are required, or else democracy will crash the ship of capitalism and destroy its own engine of profit and value creation. So much of the history of neoliberalism is about building these new forms of Ulysses Pacts. Much of international investment law or international economic law, the World Trade Organization, the Stability and Growth Pact, these are the taking away of monetary policy and giving it to the European Central Bank, was applauded by many neoliberals as a way of tying the hands of democracies and making sure capitalism goes smoother. So those would be examples of what you were saying, which is that you don't get rid of the state. Actually, in many cases, you have a stronger state, but it's a state that is limited to some actions and it is prohibited from taking other actions. The interesting thing about the exit people, they don't believe that it's possible over the long run to tie the hands of the democracy. There's a wonderful metaphor that one of these radical libertarians used, which is that, you know, to think that democracies can self-bind is like having a chastity belt on with a key within reach, that you're always going to create a situation where, as perhaps will happen with the debt break, you know, the sovereign will of the nation just takes a decision to overrule the constraint it has on itself. So if that's true, if you're not really trustful in the end of democracies being able to self-limit, then at some point you might want to say, well, let me just need to get out of here and make something new and compose it of people who we actually trust. So we're not dealing with the problem of the masses, not dealing with the problem of people who are dependent on a welfare system, not dependent in their minds of like new immigrants who might ask for things from the government, et cetera, et cetera. So the impulse to exit really comes out of this, is like worrying that the first neoliberal solution is inadequate and insufficient for actually protecting capitalism in the long run. And in its extreme version, it does take that step that most neoliberals don't take, which is just to say, what if instead of just refashioning the state, we just do away with the state altogether and replace all of the functions of the state with private service providers. So you could enter into a literal contract with the real estate company that provides your home and your land, a contract with the security company that can give you protection. You enter into relationships with third-party insurance companies that can, you know, settle disputes between you and people who you sign other contracts with. You know, you can pay a toll for the road, you can do whatever, you can pay fees for everything that would otherwise be paid for by taxes. And that's, you know, it's often treated as like a completely absurd proposition. But in fact, it's the direction in which much of capitalism has been moving for some time now. I mean, there has been a very large privatization of social services, the selling off of public utilities, the selling off of things like postal services to private service providers. In the United States, the really rapid growth of private police forces on university campuses, for example. The rise of gated communities that provide their own police, their own infrastructure, and have their own sets of rules inside of existing rules. So that vision of exit is one that pushes on neoliberal policy quite hard. And it sort of suggests that things might have to go one step further. Where I think that the kind of tactical question gets really interesting is, I think, best represented by the figure of Javier Milei, the recently elected president of Argentina. Because he's a good example, right? I mean, for sure, he's the first anarcho-capitalist head of state. And that, as you suggested yourself, should be an oxymoron or a contradiction in terms, right? I mean, that there should, it shouldn't be possible to be a believer in anarchy and yet be the head of a state.
Yes, maybe we should say self-proclaimed anarcho-capitalist, right?
Self-proclaimed. Well, I mean, all we have is people's proclamations, right? I just read an interview with him, and he says, interestingly, like, I'm an anarcho-capitalist in my principles, but I am a minarchist in reality. So a minarchist would be the idea of you can have a very small state that's reduced to protecting property, contract, and kind of external security.
Yeah, I saw this totally absurd video where he stands in front of a chart showing like the government ministries, and he rips down all the ministries that are associated with the welfare state.
Yeah.
And he only keeps what's to him like the essentials that keep up property rule, the finance ministry, for instance, or the police. Which for him should be the core body of kind of this minimalist neoliberal state.
Sure, exactly. So, I mean, I think you can see it two ways. Either he's a hypocrite and he's actually doing something that's not as radical as his proclamations say, or he's a pragmatist. And as many socialists, for example, before him would have said, this is not a final state, but it's a transitional state. You know, we have to do, let's say, bourgeois parliamentary politics before we can get to like dictatorship of the proletariat. I mean, there's a strong tradition in, on the left of sort of imperfect way stations on the path to a final destination. And I think that it's helpful to think about, if you're more familiar with debates on the left between socialists and communists in the early 20th century, if you start thinking about libertarianism and neoliberalism as being engaged in that kind of a debate right now.
Good point.
Right? The same way that socialists and communists thought they were each other's worst enemy at certain moments in the 1920s, same thing on the in the libertarian world. People who embrace this, you know, the use of the state, who go for crypto rather than fiat, or gold rather than crypto. These are like fierce ideological debates. And they used to be just like on Reddit or online or in dorm rooms. But now Argentina shows us like, no, they're like in the, you know, national elections of like very important states. So it's worth sort of, I think, keeping an eye on these otherwise obscure ideological arguments.
Just as a footnote before we return to some of the figures of like these, crack up capitalists like Peter Thiel, for example, you start your book off with him and also talk a bit about some of the extreme cases of building startup nations kind of. Do you think like Argentina could become like kind of a new laboratory for some new or old fashioned version of neoliberalism like Chile under the Chicago Boys, for example?
I mean, so far, it's only been about a week since he's been elected, and or a week and a half. And so far, it looks like it's mostly going to be business as usual, right? I think that Argentina has already been a kind of a laboratory for foreign imposed forms of austerity and monetary management. And it will probably just continue in this sort of this state for a while because, you know, I think that Milei doesn't have much leverage in the parliament. He only has a small number of seats in his new party. Otherwise, it's a lot of conservative and center-right people, including Mauricio Macri, who supported him in the second round of elections. And the people who he's now putting into cabinet positions are pretty recognizable figures from the world of sort of global industry and finance, which is why the stock market has rebounded, which is why the Financial Times says that the markets are happy with the outcome in the end, right? So part of it is like, if you are a true believing anarcho-capitalist, this is a very depressing outcome because it shows that the powers of the kind of mainstream are actually very strong and the compulsions of global bond markets and the need for some debt, you know, relief from the US or the IMF is strong enough that it actually does limit properly adventurous efforts of new politics, which then itself encourages people to do it at a micro scale, right? I think the failure of something like anarcho-capitalism at a national scale will actually just make the true believers say, that's why we need to start small, or that's why we need to start online.
Yeah, let's return to like those that conceive themselves as like true libertarians or anarcho-capitalist, or some would say proprietarians, right? Because the rule of property in their eyes should be supreme.
Yeah.
You start your book off with like a really prominent figure, Peter Thiel, who like 2009 said freedom, by which he means capitalism, should be freed from democracy. And he's like a prominent figure within like kind of the global, one could say, network of those libertarians that try to actually establish micronations, startup nations, or so-called private cities around the globe. For example, in Honduras, I think he was involved there as well.
He was, yeah.
And since the state there, by popular vote, drove them out, and these private cities, they got closed down. I think the recent development is they want to sue Honduras for killing their investment, one could say. Yeah. So Peter Thiel, he's the co-founder of PayPal, which many of us use, of course, and he is co-founder of Palantir, a big data security company that, for our German listeners, sells profiling software, for example, to the German police forces. Could you describe his ideology and how does he fit like into the broader picture of the scene of libertarians with their vision of a capitalism without democracy?
Yeah, I mean, first, just as a sidebar on the Honduras thing, you know, it's not just that they want to sue Honduras. They are suing Honduras for $11 billion through the Central American Free Trade Agreement and a bilateral investment treaty with Kuwait, because part of the investment money came from Kuwait. So only worth mentioning because it shows that even these neoliberals that claim they want to exit existing state systems are also very happy to use international law of a pretty standard variety when they feel like their profits have been unfairly, you know, infringed on because of a democratic election. Mm. The Peter Thiel question, so I would, rather than focusing on him as a person, I would sort of see him as someone who it's helpful to, because his politics have twisted and turned in the sense that in 2009, he was talking about multiplying the number of nations on the globe. A few years later, he's selling services through his big company Palantir to the U.S. government itself, both city and state level, as well as finding contracts abroad, such as the U.K. and Germany, as you say. Mm. And he's helping Trump pick his cabinet, right? So after the election of Trump in 2016, he was literally had an office in Trump Tower where he was giving him suggestions for people who could fill new seats, right? So it's a very like Milei type moment where you ask yourself, is he a traitor to his own principles? One of the people that he suggested for a top cabinet position was Balaji Srinivasan, who I talk about in the book, who is another kind of avowed exitarian anarcho-capitalist who wants to start a nation by first crowdsourcing membership or sort of citizens and then finding a place on the earth to touch down and create it in the real meat space. So the question is like, is this a betrayal of principles to turn to statehood or is it a kind of a tactical shift? Mm. And the reason why I would say it's a tactical shift is that similarly to the early 20th century analogy to leftism, I think it's important to understand that the people in my book see a kind of global struggle happening between the forces of what does get called, even though I hate the term, like wokeism, like woke statism, which they falsely understand as like a global ideology of the elites who are enforcing their ideas of progressive redistribution and like state worship and social justice and equality through the institutions of universities, through mass media.
Which is kind of funny and super paranoid because everything works in their favor, as you also describe in Globalist, your book, where these supranational institutions work in the favor of capital.
They're designed to protect their interests.
But in the end, they can't get enough, right?
Yeah. First of all, they can never get enough. Second of all, you need to understand how they sort of see things dialectically, the way that good Marxists and socialists see things dialectically, which is that appearance is not always reality. And so the fact that it would seem that entire set of institutions was created to safeguard free trade and safeguard private property, to them, seen dialectically, actually, this has just created the platform for like a counter-revolution against capitalism. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, if you want to oppose that, if that's your mindset, that like elites are locked together from Berlin to Washington to Tokyo, trying to roll out like a big green, like LGBT agenda, which is what they think, then you have to find your allies wherever you can. And if this person is a bit of like a populist and a protectionist, and doesn't really, you know, pass the smell test for like perfect libertarian principles, but they also think that the woke green elites are the biggest global threat, then you form an alliance with them. I think that is definitely Peter Thiel's mindset, which is like, he's not a purist in the sense that I only need this particular kind of politics or else I'm out. He's tactically saying, how can we put pressure on what I see as an oppressive governing system to create cracks in it wherever I can? So I'll promote, you know, people running for Senate in Ohio or in Arizona, even though I might not believe very much in government or democracy, because that way you can create a lightning rod for people's dissatisfaction with government in general. This is the Murray Rothbard principle of right-wing populism, which is that Murray Rothbard hated government, total anarchist, but advised presidential candidates because he saw politics as a great way to like destroy the system from the inside. Mm. Because if you can actually get candidates in office that expose the bankruptcy of government at large, then you create disaffection with politics as such, and people will turn away from the state and start to build small worlds for themselves in small consensual communities and turn away from governments. So I think that someone like Thiel is, you know, he's operating first on principles of self-enrichment, which is just where can I make most money most quickly. But secondly, he's operating on this idea of this is a multi-front war, and it sometimes takes strange allies, and you need to kind of think on your feet as you go about what's going to be the most effective way to achieve your agenda. And in that sense, he's a political strategist of a normal kind, but one that can look inconsistent and strange from the outside.
Mm. I wondered, Quinn, how more mainstream figures compared to Peter Thiel, mainstream figures such as Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, fit into this picture of libertarianism, especially Elon Musk. He is kind of promoting right-wing narratives of anti-wokeism on his platform X, also anti-unionism in his factories. And he kind of feels like he's above democratic rules. During lockdown, for example, he kept open factories and endangered the health of workers. So in a lot of respects, we see that he is quite similar to some of the diehard libertarians. But at the same time, we see that he's applauded for being a business genius and he's invited all around the world by governments. So what do you think? How do these more mainstream figures fit into the picture of crack-up capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk have one thing in common anyway, which is that they've both sort of changed their place of residence for tax reasons in the last couple of years, right? I think that the voting with your feet that happens inside of the United States for reasons of escaping personal income tax and navigating to places with lower labor rights is a fact of the last few decades that's only been accelerated in the last couple of years. Escaping lockdown was one of Elon's big arguments for relocating to Texas. And in Texas, he's starting up what is sort of a new version of a company town, right? Starlink is based out of Starbase, Texas, which is a territory that's like sort of completely owned by Musk. He houses the employees there. They all sort of live in this self-contained space. And it offers the vision, which I do mention in the book, that Nevada pitched recently, which is that if people came to Nevada with business ideas and investment, they would be able to write their own laws for their own municipalities. So that, I think, fragmentation of state uniformity of laws is something that takes us back to more of a 19th century vision of the frontier. And it's very much in line with the political imagination of a Bezos and Musk, who have the false belief that they are self-made individuals who have not been reliant on state subsidy and state protection the entire time. Mm. So once again, I mean, I think it's a beautiful example of hoping for something very large in the project of achieving something a little smaller. And so if you threaten to go to Mars or an off-world colony, as Musk and Bezos do, then I think that American politicians are kind of gullible enough that they're willing to like try to, you know, bribe Bezos and Musk to stay on Earth by giving them better tax arrangements in this state or that state. Mm. So it's kind of a caricature of what the threat of exit can do. But it's one that, like many things in American life, is a caricature that's real.
Mm. And what would you say, like, how can we picture, like, of course, there's no, like, conspiracy or stuff like that. Like, they meeting, like, in a secret room, Peter Thiel and other, like, libertarians, and plotting where they can prop up the next zone or something like that. Mm-hmm. For example, for German listeners, I would encourage you to listen to a podcast with Andreas Kemper, which I did, who also researches, like, the German scene or the German-speaking scene of these libertarians. People like Titus Gebel in Germany or the Mises Institute, even within the Alternative für Deutschland, yeah, there are people who like kind of belong to this proprietarian scene. I think it would be good for our listeners to kind of have a feeling how they can think of like this network of people coming together and investing And also, you can maybe give examples, more recent examples of like these startup nations. I found it interesting to read in your book, for example, about Saudi Arabia and the private city that's erected there, NEOM, because a lot of people saw in the news like this huge architectural project, the line, and everybody's like, oh, that's interesting what they do. Oh, that's fucking stupid what they do. Mm-hmm. But the thing behind that, that this is an extra legal economic zone, for me at least, this point got lost like in the conversation. So maybe talk a bit about how we can picture like this network, how they are interconnected, these kind of libertarians, and what are some recent examples of their like extreme vision of radical capitalism?
Yeah, no, I think that the kind of networks that Andreas Kemper and also Raymond Crabb and his recent book, Adventure Capitalism, so it's kind of both of their books and my book are kind of circling around some of the similar characters in many cases. I think that, you know, there are, of course, small groups of often very wealthy libertarians who are trying to plan ideas for free private cities. You can join their mailing list, right? I mean, they have videos you can watch online. But to me, they're not the big story, right? Like they are like the little dog chasing behind the big semi-truck that's driving far ahead of them. The big semi-truck is not isolated groups of ideologically driven people, no matter how wealthy they are. The big truck is the direction of global capitalism in the last 20 plus years, which is towards places like China, towards places like Dubai and the Gulf Emirates, Saudi Arabia. These are the kind of behemoths. These are like the locomotives of economic profit through different devices of extraction, whether it's literally drawing oil out of the petrochemicals out of the earth, or if it's extracting labor from the countryside, as China has done, and kind of materializing it in skyscrapers and, you know, superfluous sites of real estate investment. Those are places that people like Titus Gabel can only watch admiringly from afar, right? I mean, that's one of the things I'm trying to get at in the book, which I think we don't do enough, which is to kind of show how Asian capitalism and Middle Eastern capitalism has really been, for the point of view of Western libertarians, like the future. And they haven't been in the driver's seat. They've been in observer's seat. And we actually aren't very good in North America anyway at writing global histories in which America is not the center of the story. But I think if you write through the perspective of zones and in some of the more creative libertarians, they've been more aware of that. They've been like, America's over, Europe's over. It's been about China for a while now. So I think if you look at it that way, then you see like that places like NEOM are much more interesting because they show how the zones are not displacing the state or undermining the state, but these are actually tools of the state. So I, in that sense, I'm totally agree with what Milanovic says about political capitalism or what Ian Bremmer and others have called state capitalism. As long as we don't misunderstand that to mean fully centralized planning or sort of centralized control of the economy, because that's the secret of Chinese state capitalism, is it has both central control, but then decentralized economic investment and economic enterprise. And it's managed that balance very well. The decentralized part has been managed through these special economic zones. The example of NEOM is great because it was promoted by Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, as kind of the center of his Vision 2030 plan. And when he was originally describing it, he was describing it as like the world's first true private city, in the sense that first it would be outside of the laws of Saudi Arabia. So meaning, importantly, you could do things like buy and consume alcohol. You wouldn't be constrained by the same sort of laws around morality and conduct that you are inside of Saudi Arabia proper. But then also people would be able to buy shares in the city. So it would, as he said, be floated on the stock exchange. So this would become the first zone, he said, floated on stock exchange. I don't know which one he had in mind, but this would seem like a folly or kind of a frivolous, silly thing. But it's probably the most intense site of global investment today of anywhere in the world. The amount of money that's been put aside for it. It combines both residential, but also big green hydrogen projects, huge desalination plants, a massive floating harbor that will, you know, become a new logistics hub for the region. You know, aside from that, like ski resorts and sites for the future Asian Winter Olympics and recreation, as well as new, very creative ideas for logistics and transport. I mean, as you mentioned, it's a 250-kilometer linear city, one line, that has employed almost all of the famous architectural studios in the world, right? From Co-op Himmelblau to Zaha Hadid Architects, very centrally involved. Norman Foster was the only one who bowed out after the death of some Bedouins who were resisting being displaced. So for me, if you're interested in capitalism without democracy, or you're interested in the idea of like private government, then those are the places that are kind of on the forefront and cutting edge. And as interesting and sort of it can be to uncover these spiderweb networks of, you know, libertarians, often they're not the real movers in this story. And the movers are still maybe headline people like MBS and the decisions being made in southern China about the future of Hong Kong are, of course, very interesting here too. Will Hong Kong preserve its sort of exceptional status, or will it simply become like another province of the mainland? Mm-hmm. I think that there's much is at stake there, but it's interesting how, for example, even as China de-exceptionalizes Hong Kong, it's still creating more special economic zones. For example, in the island of Hainan, there was a recent one created. So this arbitrage between a kind of a lumpy landscape of laws is, I think, that it's not going anywhere, but it may indeed remain sort of better harnessed by state capitalist governments like China and Saudi Arabia, and ever less likely to escape into these supposed zones of freedom that the libertarians have so dreamed of. Mm.
Just as an outlook, when we look at this broader picture of state capitalist government that you mentioned and that drive the like radical capitalist development, also like libertarians like from the West that invest like in private cities and push these ideas, can you paint us a picture what the future could look like? What kind of scenarios do you see for this capitalism without democracy? Mm-hmm. Because even in liberal democracies, democracy is under pressure. But people here could say, why should I care about these ultra wealthy investing in private cities or these state capitalist run governments? I'm not living there. Mm-hmm, it's bad for the people there, of course, but I might benefit because of cheap working conditions. Can buy my iPhone a bit cheaper, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So what's the threat for us here? Maybe it comes back like a boomerang or something like that. So talk a bit about what the future, like a dystopian future, could look like of a capitalism without democracy, and how that could affect our listeners who most likely will live in liberal democracies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think that in the US, it's much easier to imagine a kind of a near future where the sort of twin challenges of kind of climate change and inequality produce more and more kind of distance between currently unified territories. So I think the COVID-19 pandemic and response was like a very interesting moment in the US anyway, where things happened very quickly that nobody thought would happen for our lifetimes, which is to say, the territorial United States kind of started breaking up. Actually, there was like a New England compact up here and a Southern compact of states there. Governors who were getting PPE and necessary supplies flown in had to have them under armed guard to make sure that governors from other states wouldn't be expropriating them and taking them to their state. There was, in the Italian and Indian case, the creation of like green zones and red zones. It's places that had like different levels of lockdown, basically. So that, I think, you know, gave us, first of all, a vision of how quickly the sort of redivision of territory can take place. I think that the techniques that we have about doing that on purpose for reasons of economic expediency can also very quickly become sort of things that affect us more closely. So one thing I'm thinking of is in the Berlin-Brandenburg airport, there was much discussion of the fact that part of the airport itself is sort of extraterritorial so that they can do rapid deportation of potential refugees right inside the airport, because you've never actually set foot on German soil, so you can't actually lodge, you can't lodge a request for refuge. So that's something that is a kind of zoning technology, not on the side of extreme wealth, but actually extreme kind of powerlessness or like vulnerability. Mm. It wouldn't surprise me that a right-wing government, let's say in Saxony or Thuringia, in the next little while, wouldn't try experimenting with creating zones to encourage investment that lifted certain kinds of environmental regulations or labor regulations. This is already happening in neighboring states to Germany. And it's having the effect of course, eroding people's faith in democracy as a practice, and also decreasing the chance of an actual response to the climate challenge. So I think that right now we're in a kind of a swing where the EU is sort of enforcing sovereignty at the European level by saying we'll do things like carbon border adjustment taxes and big investment funds for green energy, for example. But even within the EU, you have the zoning alternative. So Poland and Hungary saying, no, we're departing from that. We're going to bring in mobile investment here. We're not going to go along with those kind of regulations. Mm. And I mean, that's not quite dystopian, but I think that the zone offers the thin edge of the wedge to undermine attempts at kind of democratically legitimized forms of response to problems of climate change and inequality in particular. So yeah, I think that maybe rather than entertain the most far-flung sort of sci-fi visions, I would just say that it's helpful, I think, to reconceive of the challenge of European near future right now is one between kind of, is democratic sovereignty something that can be exerted, or will it be eroded through these small acts of kind of effective secession?
Quinn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ja, ihr Lieben, das war's. Das war der Dissens-Podcast für diese Woche. Ich möchte Danke sagen, dass ihr dabei wart. Ich mache ja nicht alle Tage englische Folgen, aber in diesem Fall dachte ich mir, es lohnt sich, und ich hoffe, das seht ihr auch so. Wenn ihr euch für Quinn und sein Buch Crack Up Capitalism oder im Deutschen Kapitalismus ohne Demokratie interessiert, dann schaut doch mal in die Shownotes, da habe ich entsprechende Infos verlinkt. Und ich werde auch ein Exemplar der deutschen Ausgabe verlosen unter allen Fördermitgliedern. Also wenn ihr noch nicht dabei seid, dann macht doch jetzt mit. Dissens braucht auch weiterhin neue Fördermitglieder, und ihr tut damit nicht nur etwas Gutes und sorgt dafür, dass ich kostenlos, unabhängig und werbefrei für alle da draußen senden kann. Nein, es winken auch Goodies und eben auch wöchentlich die Chance auf einen Verlosungsgewinn. Dieses Mal eben das Buch von Quinn. Ja, das war's dann auch von mir für dieses Jahr. Dissens ist nächste Woche in der Winterpause. Da bekommt ihr dann eine Folge von der Was tun Crew auf die Ohren. Und wir hören uns dann wieder, ja, in aller Frische und hoffentlich gut rübergerutscht im neuen Jahr, in der ersten Januarwoche. Ja, danke euch fürs Zuhören. Bis zum nächsten Mal.